Music from the Dave Holland Octet here on WBGO 88.3 FM and WBGO.org. Recorded live at Birdland the year 2009. They call that tune Pathways. It's the title track. On the drums, my special guest, Nate Smith. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, if you think you're just getting to know Nate Smith by his new album, Kinfolk, you are wrong. He's worked with so many wonderful folks. Chris Potter, Joe Jackson. I love Joe Jackson. Stepping Out, y'all remember him. Jose James, Ravi Coltrane, Steve Wilson, so much more. The great Betty Carter. We're going to talk about her. We're going to talk about Nate Smith right here on WBGO. How's it feel listening to yourself on a track that you did almost 10 years ago? Yeah. Can I say almost 10 years ago? Is that scary for you?
It is a little bit scary. Well, now that you've pointed it out, Nicole, I can't run from it now. It was almost 10 years ago, yeah. And it feels great. I'm very proud of it. You know, I loved playing with Dave. Learned a lot from playing with him. He's a great musician.
Yeah, Dave Holland is also on Kinfolk, right?
He is. He is. He was gracious enough to appear on two tracks. And, you know, I'm honored to have him. He's a big part of my story.
All right. Speaking of your story, let's get that story started. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some folks are getting to know a bit of your story through Kinfolk, Postcards from Everywhere. But I love interviews because I always say it's a chance for us to get to know the person inside the musician. We know the musician.
Right.
But we got to get to know you personally. Yeah. So one of the songs on this album is called Morning in Allison. That represents home for you, right?
It does. It does. I grew up in a small city called Chesapeake, Virginia. It's actually not that small geographically. It's pretty big. And it's a part of a larger area down there called Hampton Roads, which is seven cities. So Norfolk, Chesapeake, Portsmouth, Virginia Beach, Suffolk, Newport News, Hampton. Did I do that right?
I think you said Hampton.
I said Hampton, all right? I'm forgetting one. Somebody help me out. Call in. Anyway, I grew up in a house with, three older siblings, mom and dad. My dad had a big record collection. And he used to play this. The stuff he liked was like the late 70s, early 80s instrumental R&B. So he was into George Duke, Joe Sample, Quincy Jones, sort of like the Bob James, like the sort of golden age stuff that has been sampled and resampled many times over by now. So I grew up listening to that. That was my soundtrack, and that was my introduction to it. And also they would host parties at the house.
All right.
So that was the music they party to, too. You know, they would put on that music, and I would see people dancing to instrumental music, and I would be like, oh, you can actually party to this. You know, this is, you know, there was joy in the way that they received the music and listened to it.
Yeah.
So, you know, that is kind of where I started. My older brother played drums in band, so I used to watch him play.
Okay, were you that younger sibling that wanted to be like my big brother?
My big brother. I have two big brothers and a sister. My closest, the one who's closest to me in age is Ted, and he was the one who played the drums. And he played in high school band, and he played in a couple bands, you know, like just for fun. And I would watch and mimic what he did and try to like, you know, absorb it. I didn't even touch the drums until I was maybe 9 or 10 years old, but I watched and, you know, I made notes about what he was doing in my mind. I was like, oh, so his hands are doing this, his feet. And I was kind of putting it together.
Mm.
So he was, I would say, the first drummer I got to see up close in person was my brother.
Wow.
Yeah. And I kind of absorbed that. But then, you know, as I got into music full on and became sort of obsessed with it, that's when, I started to, dig into my dad's record collection. And then I also started to be curious about stuff I was hearing on the radio. I got into like the Police when I was a kid. Living Color came along and blew my mind. And Sting and Peter Gabriel and all that stuff that was happening in Prince came along and, you know. I mean, Prince kind of blows everybody's mind. So that was sort of my pathway in. I didn't discover jazz really until, I mean, it was always in the house.
Always.
But I didn't really find my connection with it until I was actually watching a documentary about Sting called Bring On the Night. It came out in 1985. It was right after he left the Police, and he formed this band with Branford Marsalis, Kenny Kirkland, Omar Hakim, and Daryl Jones. And these are all really great musicians, you know, jazz musicians. So I was like, so who are these guys playing with him? And then I started to dig into all those guys. I started to dig into Branford. Mm-hmm. Which led me into a whole other, you know, his work with his brother. And so that was kind of my pathway in. And later, I got back into the 70s, 80s stuff when I discovered hip hop. Mm. That was like my, you know, when I was in college listening to A Tribe Called Quest and finding out where those samples came from. And so that was, you know, it was all kind of came, it all kind of existed at an intersection for me. You know, it was like I would find one thing that would lead me to another thing, and it took me down the rabbit hole.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Pathways. It's interesting. We just, mm-hmm. we played a song called Pathways. Mm. We're talking about your pathway.
Absolutely.
Pathways. Mm-hmm. To this music, it's mm-hmm. so interesting how, I mean, you talk about Sting, mm-hmm. Prince, Bob James, mm-hmm. hip-hop.
Yeah.
This music, I always say, whenever you think that you don't know jazz, mm-hmm. rethink that, because it's been in so many of our lives since the first time we heard music.
Absolutely, yeah. It has. And you know, you can point to a number of hip-hop artists, you know, especially from the time I was a teenager. We remember A Tribe Called Quest and De La Soul and Black Sheep and that sort of jazzy hip-hop gangstar, that sort of jazzy hip-hop intersection where the beat makers and producers were clearly influenced by jazz musicians.
That's right.
And so that it opened up a whole portal in my mind about where are these sounds coming from, you know? So you discover these samples, you know, you discover Gary Bartz's records and you discover, you know, more of Herbie's records, and you know, so it's kind of everywhere all the time. You know, this jazz it exists in every genre of music, really.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Now, how do we get to the fabulous Betty Carter? Mm-hmm. You leaving Virginia eventually. And meeting up with this amazing woman who I hear, you know, she hand selected the gentleman that she chose to have work with her. So how were you so lucky?
Well, you know, so while I was in school, it kind of goes back to being in college. So I leave Chesapeake, I go to James Madison University, and I, during the summers, I had gigs. I worked at Paramount's Kings Dominion for 2 summers in a row. I was doing a Motown review show playing. Then the summer between my junior and senior year, I got this gig at Disney World, the Disney Grammy All-American College Jazz Band. It's pretty official. That's pretty official.
Wow.
Know? Yeah.
I didn't know that about you.
Absolutely. I was wearing the tuxedo. You know, I was on stage. Like, Mickey would come out and dance. And it was a thing, you know. But in that band, I met a great trombonist named Andre Hayward from Houston. And Andre had just done Jazz Ahead with Betty. I think that was the first year Jazz Ahead had happened. And Jazz Ahead is a thing that Betty started originally in Brooklyn, where she would bring musicians from all over the country together to meet each other, to play each other's tunes and put on a concert. And she would select all those musicians herself, you know? So Andre passed my information along to Betty. He was, you know, he was my agent. He was my acting agent. And then the following January, I met Betty at IAJE in Atlanta. And so my student group was playing there. She came to the concert, she heard me play. And then a couple weeks later, Andre called me and said, yeah, man, you know, Betty wants to have you at Jazz Ahead this year.
Wow.
So I was, you know, I was geeked.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, you know, you're easy on the eyes now. Do you think that had something to do with Betty? I heard, look, let me tell you, me and Betty would have been cool. You think that had something to do? She said,
I don't know. I don't know. I just, whatever happened, I feel like, I feel very lucky that she chose me because, you know, she's a master teacher. And so many great musicians came through her band. So whatever it was, whether she thought I was, you know, cute or thought I was, you know, eager and kind of green, that I think, and I do think she sensed that about me, that I was really curious to know more about the music. I think she was very, you know, she had a reputation of being tough on her bandmates, and she could be, but I never experienced that. She was kind to me, you know.
Or maybe you took it a different way.
Maybe. Yeah. That's true. And I think that I was, there was just a real sort of sincerity. I was really just wide-eyed about it. And I think she just saw it and just thought, this poor little country boy, let me take it easy on him.
So, now, what is one of the most memorable things, more memorable things that you can say you learned or you gained from the experience with Betty Carter? I'm sure there are many.
There are many,
You can pick out one.
Betty, you know, Betty, we kind of forget how much of a trailblazer she was.
Yeah.
She ran her own label. She handled her business. It was really cool to see her navigating some of the stuff that she had to encounter and to see her be so firm with venues and be firm with, you know, I remember we were playing a show in Atlanta at, was it Atlanta? I think so. It was at the Essence Jazz Festival.
Oh, wow.
Way back. This is 1999, maybe. No, I'm sorry. Forgive me. 1997. And there was a photographer who would not stop taking pictures. And Betty let him have it. She let him have it, you know, in no uncertain terms. Just let the cat know, this is it. You're done. And that was one of sort of many examples of me just kind of seeing her being so tough and so strong. She had to be, you know. She was handling business, and also on and off stage, you know. She always knew musically where everything was. She always knew the form, even though she would, you know, stretch and manipulate the time. She always knew where she was. And you had to keep up, and she kept you on your toes. So, you know, there are a number of lessons. I think about her a lot as I get older, and as I go further as a musician, I think about Betty a lot.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, how about that? So we're going to get into a tune that you picked.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me why this particular tune. I asked him to pick some Betty Carter tunes. And again, that's probably really hard to do.
Yeah.
So we're talking about Betty.
Mm-hmm.
But talk about Look What I Got.
Look What I Got. I heard that tune. I think I remember even way before I even knew who Betty Carter was. We all remember that episode of The Cosby Show where Betty was on as a guest. And she taught the girls how she, you know, Vanessa and her friends are trying to take singing lessons. And she comes on stage and she plays that tune at the end of the show. And I thought, number one, the tune was beautiful. But number two, there was something about her even then, seeing her on TV, you know, in Chesapeake, Virginia, so far removed from actually knowing her.
Wow.
There was something about her then. I thought, you know, this, she's interesting. You know, who is she? You know? And yeah, that was sort of my first introduction to her, to a person who would be very important to my career.
All right. Well, you asked, you know, back in the day, you said, who is she?
Mm-hmm.
And look what I got. Betty's about to show you who she is. Mm-hmm. Right here on WBGO 88.3 FM and WBGO.org. Miss Betty Carter on WBGO 88.3 FM and WBGO.org. They call that tune Look What I Got. We've got one of her protégés. Is that right?
Yeah, I guess
call you
could
that?
Say, yeah. Certainly an alum of the Betty Carter School of Jazz.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm sure that, you know, she's smiling down quite proud of
hope so.
You.
I hope so. I hope to make her proud.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Nate Smith is here in the house at WBGO. Now, you said this is your first on-air interview. I don't believe that.
It's the first live one, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I've done a phone interview, but never in studio.
Wow.
So, yeah, I'm feeling...
You're a pro already.
Hey, I'm trying to keep up, you know. I'm trying to keep up.
Now, it's funny, you know, ladies and gentlemen, I've known Nate, has it been 10 years? We met in Atlanta.
That's right.
Stephon Harris.
That's right. That's right.
And you were there.
That's right.
And we met, and we've been friends ever
That's
since.
Right.
Even though I was in Atlanta, you were in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always asking, I used to always ask Nate, like, when is an album coming
right.
out?
Right.
When are you
right.
doing an album?
That's right. That's
did I
right.
bother you, or did I bother you
No, it was actually important to have that encouragement, to have that support, and to have somebody lighting a fire under you, you know, to, you know, put your music out. You
yeah.
And, you know, I do appreciate the idea that you were kind of checking in on me too.
You got to check in on your folks.
You got to check in on your people.
On your kinfolk.
On your kinfolk. You know, I did put out, I did like smaller records
right.
before this project, but this is definitely the most ambitious project I've done.
All right.
For sure. And the first official jazz band leader project too.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to talk about kinfolk in just a few. We're going to keep going on this pathway.
Mm-hmm.
of music with Nate, and we're going to talk about you moving on from Betty and other good stuff. So let's talk about that, because we got some other wonderful musicians we're going to talk about too
sure.
with you.
Sure. So after Betty, I played with her a little while on and off for the last couple years of her life. And then she brought jazz ahead from New York to the Kennedy Center. And that was 1998, spring of 1998. And we remember how it was so, she was super excited about it, and she was just thrilled to have it there. And then she passed away in that September. So, you know, we all lost Betty. It was, you know, a big loss for the world, but especially for the community of musicians that she nurtured, you know. So, you know, I was still living in Virginia at the time. And shortly before Betty passed, I was a student at Virginia Commonwealth University. And while I was there, I met Dave Holland. He came as a guest artist, and he, you know, I I remember him walking in, and he's this legend, and all the kids were just so, you know, shook. Dave Holland walking in, everybody was shook. And he played with Miles, you know, Chick Corea. Like, he's got this, you know. But he was the most humble, most centered guy. He came in, he was all about the work. And that's something that I've stuck, that has stuck with me. I remember thinking that. So I got to meet him, and that seed was planted then. And then for the next few years, I was kind of living in Richmond and playing as a musician, working as a freelance musician. Different gigs, different, you know, bands, different jazz groups, R&B bands, like, you know, wherever I could get a gig, basically. And I was also writing songs and really focusing on making tracks and making beats, because that's another part of what I do. And during that process, I don't know how I discovered this record. Maybe I was out CD shopping, or maybe I heard someone talk about it, but I found this record by George Duke, who, you know, was another big sound source of music in my home. And I remember, you know, seeing the album cover, and it was him with these really cool looking shades on. He had this afro, and the sun was shining on him. And the record was called A Brazilian Love Affair. And I remember I took it home and I put it on, and it was life changing for me. Mm-hmm. It really was, because that record, the sounds on that record, the writing on it, the musician, the way the musicians play, the way George plays on the record. He was always and will remain one of my favorite musicians. Wow. But that record in particular, there's something about it, the atmosphere, the mood on that record that really inspired me and inspired my whole, it starts, you know, lit a fire for me to pursue this like beat making sort of R&B production side of what I do too, you know. Wow. He's one of those musicians who did everything.
Yeah.
From jazz to R&B to pop, you know, and I really admire those guys who kind of break down those walls.
Yeah. Is that important to you, to be that type of musician, not necessarily stuck in a box, but, you know, kind of just being able to kick down the box or kick down the door?
And, yeah, that's very important. Yeah. That's very important. I feel like, you know, we need it. I feel like there are a few too many barriers and walls up around genre, I think. You know, I think we live in this age where musicians can do whatever they want to do. And can potentially share it with thousands of people. And as long as what they're doing is authentic and they can point to their influences and understand what it is they're doing and point back to the master musicians, then I don't see anything wrong with blurring genre lines or being a musician who's open to playing anything.
Yeah.
I think we need more of it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting, you mentioned a word about Dave Holland, mm-hmm. and you mentioned, you know, him sticking with you. Humble, which is a word that I use to describe you over and over and over again, because, you know, there's, you know, you're viral, you know, on YouTube. Right. Ladies and gentlemen, when you go viral, that means something. Boy. And there's like part 40 of Nate Smith drumming his behind off. Boy. He does things with that drum set that really makes you go, say what? But you're so humble, and you're just someone who I really admire for that. Mm. So we want to talk about Kinfolk. Let's get into Kinfolk. And
sure.
It does take time to put together a great album. What made you say, I'm ready to now do this and put this out there into the world? It wasn't me. I mean, I know I annoyed you for some time. There had to been something else.
Listen. I was very, when it started to come into view and I could see the finish line, I was very excited to share it.
Yeah.
You know? And I was, you know, I was very excited to share it with you and say, you know, you remember that record you had asked me about? Check it out. I finished it. It's done now. But Kinfolk started, really it started in 2013. It's something I've been on the path to for a long time. But it started with me taking band leader gigs and really trying to find an identity as a band leader in 2010. You know, and in those early gigs, Jaleel Shaw and Fema Ephron were on those gigs. So they've been with me for this whole ride.
Uh-huh.
Then, as time went on, I got to know Jeremy Most, who's another very important figure on this record, because he exists kind of in the middle of R&B and jazz. He's an R&B guy, but he can play jazz. And he has a tremendous range, and he's a really great rhythm player. And then the first couple years I worked with Jose, Chris Bowers was in the band.
Right.
The great young pianist. And got to know him and got to really just fell in love with his playing and how sophisticated he is and how musical he is. And then the project crystallized when I met Amma. That's really when it really came into view, because I knew I wanted to write tunes that had vocals. And it was important for me to collaborate with someone who could write in such a skillful way. And and I remember meeting Amma in 2011. I saw her at, she was singing backgrounds for someone, and she was featured on this one tune. And as soon as she opened her mouth, it was like, okay, I know her. I feel like I know her, you know? There was that kind of musical connection.
Like a spiritual connection.
Yeah, I think so. It was really like, there's something about her that's really familiar. And so, you know, I met her, I started writing these melodies, and we got together a couple times at the piano, and I said, you know, this is kind of what I'm thinking about when I'm playing this tune. This is kind of what this song is about. And she took it home and came back with these brilliant lyrics, you know, like first draft, like, you know, kind of done. And So you know, Amma has this really special thing that I think is very unique. Like, I feel the same it factor with her that, you know, I feel with someone like Jill or someone like Erica. Like, there's this connection, this intersection of empathy and intellect with Amma. Like, she's really, she gives you a lot of feeling, but she's also a really smart writer too. So, That's special. She's a unique musician. So that was really what made me say, okay, you know what? I think I found all the pieces for the core band. And then it was about reaching out to people who I felt were a part of the sort of trajectory of my career and asking them to appear on the record.
Do you think your time with Betty Carter has a lot to do with why, you know, the lyrics and having, you know, someone write, you know, important lyrics to your music? Do you think there's a connection to that? Because not many instrumentalists have vocals on their album. And the vocals on this particular album are really something else. So you can tell they weren't just, oh, here you go. They were well thought out and felt out.
For sure. Yeah, it was important. I'm not sure. I think what I learned most about Betty was, from Betty, from working with her, was it's very important for a vocalist to have a real specific point of view, you know. And and the two vocalists on this record, Amma and Gretchen, are very unique in that way. They have very specific sounds, specific points of view. Also, Jose, who I work with a lot, is a very specific singer, you know. So that's important to me. I think that was the most compelling thing about singing that I learned from Betty. Was, you know, she did it her way. You know, so you're always looking for musicians who do things their way. You know, so all the musicians on this record, I feel like they all have a very specific point of view. They do things their way, you know. So, yeah, I would say that lesson with Betty applied not only to the vocalists I chose, but also to everyone else that I chose for the record, too. You know?
All right. Yeah. So we're gonna get into a piece that features Amma Watt. Now, she wrote all the lyrics.
She did. She wrote every word that's sung on this record.
And actually, I want you, when you're done, we're going to play The Wait. I want you to introduce it before I play it. You should be the one.
Sure. So that's what you're going to play now?
Yeah.
Is The Wait?
Yeah. So I switched it up on you.
Okay. All right. So this song was written in the summer of 2013. And it was around the time of that infamous Trayvon Martin incident and the trial and the acquittal. And there was just this, you know, kind of sadness that I had, and we all felt around it. And I just kind of sat down at the piano and wrote this tune, and it's kind of took this shape, and it kind of took this turn. And I was like, this melody really needs someone to bring some lyrics to it that can express this feeling of exasperation, exhaustion, you know, this feeling of just really feeling tired of seeing this result again and again. But I still wanted the musical elements to have a groove and have like this really soulful vibe. So, you know, again, reaching out to Amma, she came back like the next day, maybe a week later after we met, and she had this draft and we did it, and I was blown away. And I was like, okay, so once I heard this record, I was like, I hear the rest of the album now. I hear the entire record, because I feel like this for me is one of the centerpiece tracks,
like the of
the
core,
yeah,
almost.
Yeah, it really is.
All right. Well, it is one of my favorites. I have a lot of favorites. You all know that by now. But this is one of my favorites because there is a feeling to it. But The Wait, it really just describes the song and so much more. It really describes the energy behind those types of incidents.
Absolutely.
You got some other wonderful folks on this album. I mean, this is like star-studded kinfolk postcards from everywhere. And these folks are kinfolk to you.
They are. They are. Yeah. It's the, you know, you are born into a family and you find a family.
That's true.
And so, you know, this is kind of my musical family that I've sort of found along the way. And, you know, they're all amazing. Shout out to everybody on the record. Chris Bowers, Jaleel Shaw, Fema Ephron, Jeremy Most, Ama Wutt, Gretchen Parlato, Leonel Lueke, Dave Holland, Chris Potter. Also Michael Mayo and Adam Rogers, who appear on the record too.
All right. Yeah. Now, let's see. We got the, and I'm going to send this song out. It's called Bounce Parts 1 and 2 to our own Gary Walker. Gary came to me one day and said, man, I played that Bounce Parts 1 and 2 this morning. Oh, it was good. When Gary says it's good, y'all.
Okay, but he knows what's up.
It's really good.
Oh, that's what's up. That's a big compliment.
Yeah.
I also, before we go, I do want to give a shout out to the band and let people know that we do have a show coming up.
That's right.
April 9th at New Blue. That's our next Kinfolk show. And in the meantime, I've got a show coming up this Thursday night at the Bowery Ballroom with Jose James. You'll be there. All right.
I'll be there.
So, yeah, that's going to be a fun show. It's all music from his new record, Love in the Time of Madness. So, yeah, we've got a couple things coming up.
All right.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite song on this album?
Oh, boy.
Hard to choose.
It's hard to choose. You know, I've been thinking a lot about Retold recently. That's a song that I think makes a real statement. And Home Free is probably the most personal song because it's dedicated to my grandfather, and it's preceded by an interlude which features my dad's voice.
Yeah.
And, you know, my dad passed away throughout the process of making this record.
Yeah.
So it's very cool to hear him before this song about his father.
Wow.
So yeah, it's
a personal album.
It's a very personal record. It is. And I felt like if I was going to make a band leader statement at my age, 42, you know, by the time most cats are my age, they put out 10 records, you know. So I figured I needed to contextualize some things and introduce myself to people. And I figured the way to do that was just to tell my story.
All right. Well, you know, speaking of your story, tell us something that folks don't know about you.
Oh, boy.
Tell on yourself.
Oh, man, I don't even know. Some folks don't know about me. I was in a movie which won an Oscar.
Oh.
Maybe some people know this. I played a drummer, which was a stretch. I played a drummer on the street in this movie called Birdman.
Y'all heard of that
maybe,
movie.
Maybe y'all heard of it. And it was directed by Alejandro Iñárritu, and the music was done by another really great drummer, this guy, Antonio Sanchez.
Yeah.
Everyone knows Antonio. He's the man, plays with Pat Metheny. He's amazing. But when it came time to shoot the scene, Antonio was out of town. So, you know, they put out a call, and I was there. I was available, ready for my close-up, you know. So I got on set, sat down, and there are two shots in the movie where you can see me.
Wow.
And I'm kind of doing my Nate bop on the drum, you know. So, yeah, that was I've been in a movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of the Nate bop, is that something that you coined? Is that, what would you call your style of playing?
Oh.
Because it's different. It's yours.
Oh,
boy. Do you call it something your own?
I know. I haven't called it anything. Mm-hmm. I mean.
Because there's a bop. There's a Nate bop. Maybe that's what you should call it.
And maybe, you know what? Okay, Nate bop. There you go. I don't know. I feel like I'm lucky to play with a lot of different musicians.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I find myself kind of adapting to situations as best I can and trying to sound like me.
Mm.
So, you know,
Is that hard?
Is it,
and it sounds like a weird question, but is it hard to sound like yourself?
Well, it is kind of hard to that's a very, it is a weird question, but not in a bad way. It you find over time as you play with different people, you really discover what is unique about your playing. If you can play with different people who are wildly different, but still there's one element in your playing that people gravitate to, then that's kind of your thing. You know, that's your voice. So, and I'm not even really sure what it is. I know that I really, you know, I enjoy playing pocket, like you hear on tunes like this, and I enjoy playing hip hop too, and I also enjoy playing straight ahead. So, you know, as long as I can do it and it all has a groove and it feels good, then, you know, I hope that's the essence of my sound. If we can call it Nate Bop, that's fine. You know, I'm down with that one.
As long as it just feels good.
As long as
right?
it feels good, yeah.
Okay.
For sure.
All right. Now, where can folks find you?
Where can they find me? They can find me at Nate Smith Drums on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And they can find me at natesmithmusic.com. All my tour dates are up there.
Right.
And yeah, and I'm going to be posting a lot of content, you know, blogging about this record.
Yeah.
That's a lot of that stuff is coming soon. I'm going to be writing sort of my own liner notes about each song.
Oh.
So yeah, I'll be doing a lot more, and I've a couple more projects coming out this year too. That I'll be featured on. So, and I'll be giving people heads up on all my socials about that.
All right. Now, before I let you go, what is one thing you want folks to take with them from Kinfolk?
From Kinfolk.
Is there a particular message? Is there just something that you want folks to remember about this album?
I really want people to hear, or at least imagine a little bit of themselves or their own story in the music. This music is personal, and it is my story, and it is, you know, heartfelt, but I do want people to listen to it and hear a little bit of themselves in it too. Like I wanted some of the music to touch on some feelings or memories or what have you that are universal to people. Because that's kind of the thing, and not to get too grandiose about it, but I really think that's what music is designed to do.
Absolutely.
You know, and especially now, I mean, we kind of live in a divided time. So if people can see themselves in each other and see themselves or hear their story in my music, I feel like that's, you know, mission accomplished for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you did accomplish that mission.
Thank you. Thank you, Nicole.
Nate Smith with Kinfolk, Postcards from Everywhere. Such a pleasure to have you here, not just, you know, professionally, but personally. Mm. I am so proud of you. I'm so proud of this album.
Thank you,
and,
Nicole.
You
Thank
know,
you.
I always say, just don't forget about little old Nicole.
Oh, boy.
So this
boy.
Interview.
Okay. That's impossible. That's impossible.
I tell you, I'm just, again, so honored for you to stop on by and continue to bring us this great, great music. There's only two kinds. They say good and bad.
Yeah.
And this is on the good side for sure.
I appreciate you.
So
I
we
really
thank
do.
You so much for that. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for tuning in to Afternoon Jazz. We're member supported WBGO 88.3 FM and WBGO.org.